There will be no personal nor direct attacks on anyone. And I would ask that you please try to keep down the loud cheering and the clapping. There will be no booing and no unruly behavior. With that,
this is painful, and it will be for a long time.
Donald Trump, baby! That's right, this man knows what's up!
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Well, Sean's a tough guy. I mean, I think everybody knows that. You know, Sean, he took some licks. He hangs in there.
Yeah, what's wrong with the beer we got? I mean, the beer we got drank pretty good, don't it?
Did you hear what I said?
So this is a brave council. I had no doubt about them.
That doesn't suck.
If you don't like it, too bad.
Last question. Were you high on drugs?
Last question. Kiss my...
All right, here we go. FM Talk 106.5 and Midday Mobile. Hey, y'all. Sean Sullivan, live local talk this hour. And do want to just address one thing we talked about the end of last hour before we talked to our buddy Brendan Kirby. We getting in the discussion of the utilities and kind of us pointing out, if you look at the greater picture here, it's very odd with the mainline traditional coal and natural gas and fossil fuels being used to produce electricity. People think about that completely with Alabama Power, but if you dig in, and I'm going to try to tweet this story here in a little bit, the offshoot of Alabama Power, the one that's actually been making some money as of late, is in the solar game. But at the same time, like David had pointed out, that if you put solar panels on your home, then you are charged a fee. It says Alabama Power charges a residential solar fee. So if you're producing, then you have to pay $5 per kilowatt hour. This is a ruling by the Public Service Commission, back to what we talked about last hour. You pay that back to the power company for producing your own electricity. And then I saw a bunch of y'all texted. This is fascinating. And a lot of wind power people, though I'm kind of interested in wind power. I'm interested in all of it, but I am interested in solar a whole bunch. And I may or may not, I'm getting myself in trouble right now, may or may not at some place off the grid be powering everything with solar. But Jimmy says on the text line, I don't know for certain, but I've always been told, hey, can we find this out? Because we have obviously friends, clients of ours at the original Oyster House. He said, I've been told that the original Oyster House on the causeway has to pay a fee or a fine to have the wind turbine. You know the wind turbine that's there at the original Oyster House on the causeway? You see it out there, the big white, that they have to pay a fee. Can somebody down there, Cecilia or somebody, if you listen, can you let me know if that is true? Also, this texture says, that fee is why I don't have a windmill that I wanted to build. I can't justify the cost savings without the buyback. Wow. All right. This is something. Brendan, you're on to talk about the president and executive orders and all that, and I've drug it into a utility discussion. I'm sorry.
Oh, well, no problem. I've always thought that it'd be neat to have, solar panels. It doesn't really work out with my house, though, because it's covered by trees, so
right.
It wouldn't work out. But it seems like if you are building a house from scratch and you have sun, it makes a lot of sense.
It's been fun. I've had an off-grid place for a long time to do that and experiment with it. And, it doesn't matter if it early on, if it didn't work and charge because, the wife wasn't waiting to use the computer or, somebody wasn't looking for hot water or anything like that. So it was a great place to learn. I've enjoyed it. So we'll talk.
The problem is retrofitting it, though, onto a house, I think, is expensive. I think the key
that's what they make duct tape and sheet metal screws for, my friend.
Yeah.
Okay.
And this also brings up a bigger point, I think, with the whole environmental debate. Environmentalists who want to shift to this, for environmental reasons, act like conservatives are reflexively opposed to green energy. And setting aside power companies that have a business interest in it, I think as a regular person, I'm completely agnostic about how my electricity works. I just want the cheapest, most reliable form. If the if wind or solar or Sean Sullivan you know, running on a hamster wheel is going to be able to cheaply and reliably supply energy for me, I'm signed up. I mean, that's all I care about. I think that's all most people care about.
No, and that's absolutely right. And that's, you know, I've talked in the past, and people say, one of your greeny parts of your personality. I say, yeah, it's very green, as in dollars. If I can, I'm always looking for what the most efficient way to do things. There are some people that would chase solar or wind because they want to make a point. Or people who do it as a hobby, which I think is cool. But for me, I'd like to learn everything about it, because if you could do that, that's just a way to run your life more efficiently, save money.
Right.
Where
my skepticism comes in, though, is that, you know, tomorrow or in the really near future, we can replace all of the fossil fuels with solar and wind.
No, that's silly.
It just doesn't seem realistic to me.
No, I would like to let it happen organically. You know, without market regulations on it, and without picking winners or losers, let it happen. Let it be competitive. And being competitive means keeping the old fossil fuel companies from hamstringing the new energy. I'm not saying government should prop them up like they wanted to do with Obama, but they should be protected from being hamstrung and let them do business in the open marketplace. And if it becomes an efficient way to do it, then they will succeed. I mean,
absolutely.
All right, let's get down to the meat of President Trump and his executive order. Because for 24 hours or so, a lot of us have been talking about, well, the president's got this executive order. This is going to be the cover to give Congress time to do their job and make a law here or amend a law. And you point out in your story, I think you're one of the only people I've seen, the only person I've seen doing this. You said there's another part of this. I mean, President Trump's immigration executive order, it's not just dependent on what he said and signed yesterday. There's some other part to this.
Right, absolutely. And just again for background, when somebody comes to, crosses our border illegally, alone, an adult, quite simply, you pick that person up, you can detain them while you go through the deportation process. When they come with a child, it makes it complicated for all sorts of reasons. If they're from Mexico, you can turn them around pretty easily, but if they're not from Mexico, it triggers a whole deportation process that takes a long time. And the crux of this dates back to a lawsuit that was filed in the 1980s by the ACLU on behalf of a 15-year-old girl from Central America who came alone. She was an unaccompanied minor, before that really became a big crisis. And at the time, they threw her into lockup with adults, and she was subject to daily strip searches, and it was a really bad scene. So this lawsuit dragged on for years, and it ended with a settlement in 1997 in which the government agreed, well, we're not going to jail children with adults anymore, and we're not going to hold children even alone for longer than 20 days. And that is what is being used to say that if you come with a child, you know, we can't hold you, because 20 days is not long enough to do the deportation process. So that leaves the government with just a few number of limited choices. You can either hold the parents, because you can still do that and charge them with a crime, but let the kids go, which is what causes this family separation that's become the big issue du jour, or you can just release the whole family, which is what has been done. Now, if you favor that option, you have to recognize what that means is all anyone has to do to get into the country is to show up with their kid. And the numbers have been going up because people realize you can do that. So that is the crux of it.
Okay, so this goes back, like you said, to this 97 court settlement. But what does it mean right now on getting... when the president signed this executive order yesterday, did things change on the border? Did people go, there's the executive order, it's coming down, somebody go check the fax machine. It's come through, now we'll change what we're doing?
Well, it hasn't really, because the executive order explicitly said we're going to maintain the zero-tolerance policy of charging illegal immigrants with a criminal entry offense. I've heard today reports that perhaps they're going to back off that. But at least on the text of the executive order, that continues. And the change was, well, we'll hold the families together, which I think a lot of Americans think is probably a reasonable compromise. Hold the families together, don't separate them, and send them back to their home country together. The problem is you can't do that under this court decision, this settlement. So So in order to do it, you would have to get the judge who has jurisdiction over that case to reopen the settlement and agree to waive that 20-day rule. And the judge is a federal judge named Dolly G, who's a Obama-appointed judge from California. She would have to do that. Now, my personal view, it's tough to predict how judges are going to rule, but I would think it would be very unlikely that the judge would do that. The alternative is Congress could pass a law, laying this out, which would override the settlement. But Congress doesn't pass much, so that's unlikely as well. So I really think we're back to square one. If the judge doesn't allow for that change, then families won't be able to stay together past the 20 days.
Okay, listen, we're going to run the break. Coming right back, more with Brendan Kirby from Life's Edge, Yellowhammer News, author of Wicked Mobile. Wait a second. After all the pomp and circumstance, we're back to square one? By the way, the story up on the Twitter feed at FM Talk 106.5. I'll tell you what, I'll post this up on our Facebook page, too, during the news break here, and we're coming right back.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, 120 FM Talk 106.5 and Midday Mobile on this little Friday Eve edition. Talking with Brendan Kirby from LifeSet.com, YellowhammerNews.com, also author of Wicked Mobile, available next to Funyuns and Andy Capp's Hot Fries on the end caps at your local Walgreens or CVS stores. That's usually where I find it. It's a nice combo.
That's my favorite place to get it.
It was posed up perfectly. There was the other day I took that picture for Twitter, and I saw it. There was Wicked Mobile, and right next to it, some delicious snack chips. So that's a good thing. All right. I want to get back to your story from Life's Edge. And let me do it this way. This helps me understand, because you mentioned it earlier in the segment, last segment. But I want to do this. With a family of four that's from Honduras shows up, they cross the border illegally, and Border Patrol apprehends them. Now, walk us through the scenario as it is today.
Right. I think if you were to ask most people what should happen in a scenario like that, they would say, well, we ought to gather that family up and make sure they're safe and send them back to Guatemala. And that just seems like the simple common sense way that the immigration system should work.
Right.
But the immigration system doesn't work like that because, again, if they're from Mexico, you can just turn them right around. It's pretty simple. It's almost instantaneous. But if they're not from Mexico, you can't just turn them around because Mexico has no obligation to take non-Mexican citizens into its country. So you have to arrange for them to be deported, and that takes time. It takes longer than 20 days, which is this court-imposed time limit for holding children. So, again, we just go through the scenarios. You can charge the adults with a criminal entry violation and put them into the court system and separate them from their kids and hold their kids temporarily in a Health and Human Services facility until they can be sent to a relative in the United States or a foster home. Now, as we've seen from the blowback, that's a wildly unpopular position. People hate the idea of that. For obvious reasons, But so if we can't do that, well, what else can we do? Well, we could hold the whole family together. This is another thing I think people would say seem a reasonable solution. But this court decision settlement would have to be changed in order to do that. And if you listen to the reaction of most Democrats, they think that family detention together is a horrible thing. Eric Swalwell from California said it's just as bad as separating parents from their children. So then if you can't deport them fast enough and you don't want to separate parents and children and you can't hold them all together, well, guess what? That only leaves one other alternative, which is to release them into the interior of the United States and issue them a notice to appear for their immigration court hearing, which is not going to be soon because we have a huge backlog, and then hope that they show up at that immigration court hearing, and a lot of them don't. And then, by the way, if a judge in absentia issues a deportation order in a case like this, and you want ICE then to go find that family, hunt them down, arrest them, and deport them, then you get people saying, what is ICE wasting its resources on a family like this when there's all these criminal aliens? You should be deporting the criminal aliens who are committing rapes and murders and robberies. So, you know, essentially that makes it a free pass into the United States. And if that is really the policy we want, you know, perhaps Congress ought to just be upfront about it and pass a law saying that the immigration restrictions that generally apply don't apply if you come as a family.
Wait. Then there'll be, I mean, it'll be, you know, like the Bad News Bears get together. Yeah, we're family. Yeah, that's us. We're all the Smiths, you know?
Right.
We're all
the Kirby's. And that brings up a separate issue in that there's fraud that occurs. Not all adults
say.
Traveling with children are actually related. You know, sometimes they're just adults that are posing as parents or relatives, and sometimes they're actually smugglers who are bringing kids and posing it. And the Border Patrol has ways to try to suss that out. And you know, when they find a case, you know, then they will separate them and they'll file you know, fraud charges. So they look at the behavior and to see if it looks like a genuine relationship, or if they're suspicious, they might separate them and ask you know, ask questions to try and confirm it. But yeah, I mean, it's I think even, you know, the most open borders Democrat would say that, you know, sometimes you want to separate adults and children. If they're not the real familial relationship, I don't think they want to release a kid in that situation. It's longstanding been policy that if the safety of the child is at risk, you would separate them.
And I would hope,
you know,
so.
Presumably, yeah. they would support that.
Yeah, I would hope so. And I want to go back, hit the rewind for a second here. What I heard, and correct me if I'm wrong, though, and I know this is shocking for people that think that this is all plug-and-play politics, you know, on the radio, but what you laid out kind of is the situation that occurred under the Obama administration, as in that the catch-and-release, as you said, really was the only way for the administration to go. Is that true?
Well, that is true with regards to the unaccompanied minors and the children showing up with what the government charmingly calls family units.
Right.
Of course, the Obama catch and release policy during the second term was greatly expanded to include any illegal immigrant caught by the Border Patrol within a certain number of miles of the border, who claimed that he had been in the country continuously since before January 1st, 2014.
That's right.
The date. They were released as well.
But the definition,
you know,
of families.
There's no legal reason why that had to happen. That was just the Obama administration deciding we're not going to waste our time with illegal immigrants, except for the ones who are brand new illegal immigrants. And of course, you know, I mean, it's. As a Border Patrol agent told me, even if we pick up someone who is soaking wet out of the Rio Grande River, if he says, I've been here since before January 1st, 2014, they said okay and let him go.
Well, okay, good point. So, but specific and narrowly defined as the family or the family units, as you said, that would be the same today as it was then?
Yeah. Okay. I mean, what is new about this is Jeff Sessions decided they were going to file criminal charges against the you know, illegal border crossers, even on a first time offense. And when you do that, that means you hand them over to the custody of the U.S. Marshals Service, and they're detained in a jail. And you can't put, you know, children in a jail, you know, for lots of reasons. So that part is new, but the problem is not new. The problem is, what do you do when you know, adults and children traveling together come? That was just as much a problem for the Obama administration and for the Bush administration before it is now. What's different is that the numbers have been going up. The numbers of unaccompanied children and children traveling with family, you know, are enormously higher now than they were, say, 10 years ago. Again, because people respond to incentives. And once the word got around that, hey, this is a way into the United States, you incentivize people to do it. And by the way, this journey from Central America through the desert up Mexico through territory held by drug cartels at the mercy of human smugglers, that doesn't really strike me as compassionate. That's an extremely dangerous situation to be encouraging.
Absolutely. Yeah, I was thinking about this. I don't know how this would work out. This is a little bit of the just speculative. But I was thinking back, like Chrome Detention Center and some places they had in South Florida during the Mariel boat lift and those periods of time. If you had a big detention center fenced in area, but the people were free to come in and out, but you had a house or a Quonset hut for each family, and on the corner of it, and I know this sounds like ridiculousness, but you had something that accounted for the cell, right? So the parent, the adults were in the cell, but they were right there next to their family. Even so, they would be in jail per legal, but the family would be right there with them, but not in jail. I don't know. I just wonder if there's...
Well, I don't even think you would really need that. I mean, a family-based facility, wouldn't even necessarily have to be a jail unless the person you're arresting you think is a danger in some way.
Right, no, there's a difference. I'm talking about
dangers.
Oh, yeah, the ones that are dangers, you punt them. You know, I mean, put them in jail so fast make your head spin.
These are just, the chances that, like, an actual parent would try to break out or run away, I think, would be kind of low. So it's similar to the places that we hold, the unaccompanied children. You know, they come there held for a real short-term basis in a U.S. Border Patrol facility, and then they're transferred to the Department of Health and Human Services. So they contracted out with private companies that have these facilities. They're not cages, like we've heard.
Right.
You know, they're not in there with the gorillas or whatever. These are residential-type facilities. Think of it as like a residential facility for like a drug treatment facility.
There we go. I got to jump.
It's not a jail.
Appreciate it. Brendan, people want to talk more about this. How do they find you on Twitter?
At Brendan K. Kirby.
Big thank you to Brendan, and we're coming right back. Stephen McNair is going to join us, and we're talking about the train and Governor Ivey.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, 1:36, FM Talk 106.5 at Midday Mobile on this Thursday. Glad to have you all along. And in studio, it's good to see my friend Stephen McNair joining us to talk. We want to talk about your run for office for House 97, but also some trains part of this. Now, I know, is this go into the historic preservation? Is this your interest in trains? Why are you in here talking trains with me?
Well, today it's more about the economics of rail passenger rail service and a lot less about historic tax credits and old buildings.
Okay, and I want to talk about, give us the why, because we've been reporting since day before yesterday or whatever. Today's a deadline. Governor Ivey has to sign this thing. What is this thing that Governor Ivey has to sign, and how does this all fit hand in glove with the train thing? Explain it for folks that have not been paying attention to it the whole time.
So as part of the omnibus spending bill from the federal government, there is a document that basically says that every state will commit a certain amount of state funding if the feds commit a large amount of federal funding to bring back passenger rail between the city of New Orleans and the city of Mobile. So okay. That would include stops along the Mississippi Gulf Coast as well.
And so Mississippi would pay in, when New Orleans, Mississippi, Alabama, I mean, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama pay into this?
Right now.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the current projection, because eventually they want to expand this to Orlando, Florida,
right.
Maybe up to Birmingham and Huntsville, but for the time being, simply Mobile to New Orleans.
Well, okay, but to understand this, too, to go back, and I've been watching this story for a while and talking to folks with Southern Rail Commission for a while, the infrastructure, well, might need some improvement, but it's there. I mean, it's not like we're putting a new railroad track. I mean, why aren't we doing it? We just need the cars? What do we need here?
Well, the cars are provided by the Amtrak services. Really, all we need is a terminal, and we need cooperation with those entities that own the rail lines. Amtrak does not own or operate any independent rail lines. They lease and borrow rail lines that are existing. And so in the case of the city of Mobile, it goes through the port. It's the commercial rail lines that we would have to share, which of course we did for many years up until 2005 when Hurricane Katrina knocked out the terminal and stopped rail service. So we would definitely have to take into consideration the economic ramifications of dealing with the Port of Mobile and the Port of Alabama, which is extremely important, but we can do both. We can certainly figure out.
Doesn't that happen in other cities that Amtrak passenger is running on the same lines that, here comes a passenger train, and then there's a freight train, and then there's a passenger? And
every day across the country.
Okay, so now let's get down to the cut on this. How much are we talking about? Because this is a matching fund kind of thing? Is it committing how much money for Alabama to get how much from the federal government?
We're really only talking about $5 million, a little over $5 million over a three-year commitment for the state of Alabama to receive their services. The state of
$5 million spread out easy terms.
Right. And the state of Mississippi is substantially more, because we're talking about at least three stops there.
Right.
Then New Orleans is about 10 million. And so of the state of Louisiana. And so right now, the only state who's committed all necessary funds is Louisiana. Mississippi has committed a partial amount, but it's still not good enough. And of course, the state of Alabama hasn't committed any. And time is of the essence here, because...
Yeah, today's deadline, isn't it?
Today's the deadline. So the federal money dries up for this fiscal year if we don't have a signature from the governor by close of business today.
Okay, so how much is at stake coming from the federal... Which is, by the way, as we remind folks, it's still tax dollars from somewhere. You know, I mean, it's not matching. I know we do print money, but it is tax dollars. But obviously, we're looking for federal match. How much money are we talking about that the feds would kick in?
Over 50% of what we need. So really, we only have to chip in about a third of what's necessary to build this new terminal.
Okay. Then, of course, this will go to the... Because this is going to be premature or post-mature, depending on what happens today or doesn't happen. But the terminal. Is there a definition? Is there a... You know, you deal with a lot of buildings and stuff. Obviously, you know this. Is there a... It must meet this standard to be a terminal?
There is a certain standard, but that being said, to just be a stop on the Amtrak, I mean, if anybody's taken the Amtrak from Tuscaloosa to New Orleans, when you stop in Picayune, the terminal there is a platform that mm-hmm. you step onto. And so there are different levels of that, so...
Right, that's what I was wondering. If in a short term, because I think so many times... government gets into the, or even government-private partnerships get into this. If you build it, they will come. You know, it's Disney's World of Tomorrow and whatever they're doing. They're building all these. But we could build something, if I understand this correctly, with matching, if we had the matching money for the feds and the state kicked in the $5 million over 3 years, we could build something fairly Spartan to be a placeholder.
I think we could, and that's really what we had before Katrina in 2005.
It doesn't have to be Six Flags over trains.
And Mobile really doesn't need that.
Right.
And it would be located potentially downtown where the old station was. But at the same time, you know, there's a lot of conversations now with the feasibility study of relocating the airport, of increasing the rail line, passenger rail service all the way to Brooklyn, and kind of having a commuter line there where you can basically get off your plane and then take the train to the cruise terminal or to the Amtrak terminal and continue on to New Orleans.
Yeah, you and I were talking about that the other day, just with this discussion of the airport there. But heck, I mean, you could argue, I don't know how many passengers would use it. This is the unknown. How many people that now drive down and park at the cruise, and not, believe me, I don't want to get away from people parking at the cruise terminal parking, because we need that money, we need that revenue, but could somebody get on that train in Tuscaloosa or somewhere else and ride down and step off and walk over to the cruise ship and get on?
Absolutely. And so you really have to look at passenger rail service in a two-pronged effect. One is tourism and the other is business development. And they intersect, but they're very different entities. So when you think about the business development side of it, Mobile is different. We're unique. We always say that in Montgomery. We're a special breed mm-hmm. in that we have needs the rest of the state cannot understand. For instance, we connect to the port of to the Mississippi Gulf Coast. We connect to the port of New Orleans. We connect to Pensacola. Those are three states right there that an entity in Birmingham just wouldn't understand. And so the connectivity for business purposes of Amtrak, I think, can serve a great purpose. I mean, I was in a conversation yesterday with a large national company, which is based in Mobile, and they were saying that they bus their employees all the time to the Mississippi Gulf Coast in New Orleans, but if there was a train, they'd pack it every morning.
Okay. This goes from a man like you that's running for office and a very intelligent guy, I've known him for a long time, to me, the other side. Can't we get the casinos to subsidize this? I mean, if we would get a train over there, say, listen, it's going to be the Keno Express heading over to the...
I think phase two could include that. And you got to look at it this way.
Have the casinos chip in the money. Come on.
Well, the old Gulf Breeze Express went from Mobile to Birmingham and stopped in Atmore. And so that's really the phase two of this, is if we could get the rail service back, then phase two would be heading north all the way through Alabama.
So there would be reason to have private entities get in and make, you know, make a contribution.
Absolutely. And public-private partnerships really is the future of these kind of large infrastructure projects, just like we see with the I-10 bridge.
All right, got a couple questions here for you. And by the way, just joining us, Stephen McNair. In here talking train, also remind folks if they want to get more information about your campaign.
VoteMcNair.com.
Well, that'll do it. Cameron asks Mr. McNair, can y'all touch on how much a train ticket cost and whether or not it's going to be a real form of transportation or more of a novelty?
That's a fair question, right, Debbie? You heard Brendan Kirby and I talking during the break. We love trains. I like riding on trains, but what do you see? That's a great question, and that information from Amtrak has not been made public, but when you look at the other passenger rail service, like from Tuscaloosa to New Orleans, right now it's about $40 a passenger, and so, and of course there's a first-class passenger rate and down the line.
Right.
But
add-ons.
Right, yeah. And I'm sure that there's corporate rates where if you commit a certain amount of employees, so certainly there's a novelty effect of this of somebody saying they want to go to New Orleans for the weekend and they just don't want to drive. There's that. But then there's
$40. You said the ticket from Tuscaloosa to New Orleans was $40.
We used to take it all the time from Tuscaloosa as a student.
Okay, so that's I'm thinking just as gas prices go up, it may be more comparable. Although there are other things, it depends on what you're doing because you want your car when you get there and all that. But to answer his question, we're looking at that's at least something to work off of, $40.
And also don't forget that because of the Wi-Fi services on the Amtrak trains now, you don't lose that time traveling. You actually can bill those hours and work on the way to your destination.
All right. I'll tell you what, we got more questions for you. Can you hold on through the news break?
Glad to.
All right. Coming right back. And more on just, you know, what's at stake today and what happens. When is it? Is it like close of business or when is it?
Close of business today.
Well, Governor Ivey could say, we never close at the Blunt Mansion, darling. Well.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Right, 150 FM Talk 106.5 and Midday Mobile on this Thursday. I'm just looking through more text about trains. Stephen McNair running for House District 97 in, but also man that pays a lot of attention to things going on here in Mobile. What's your gig day in and day out? What you doing?
The day job is a historic preservation consultant, and we work very hard to bring back a lot of the buildings in downtown Mobile and create jobs and put in new restaurants and new apartments and get the downtown being where it should be.
And there's way I would segue into this because this texter said, and this has come up about every time we talk about train and train platforms for downtown for some kind of passenger, and I'm gonna just let you have it. I have not primed you on this. Texter says, well, what about the old GM&O building? Why not there?
I think that's a perfectly valid option to look at. I don't see why not. It's on the rail line itself. That's the kind of thing where we'd have to talk to the Port Authority and see what kind of commercial tracks are accessible there and what the future is for that property. But
it's a transportation hub, man.
I agree.
When that was determined, I think back during when it was Mayor Mike Dow, I said I was a communications and English student in college and not geometry or drawing, but it's the worst shaped hub I've ever seen. With the hub over on one side, you know, just if you were going to hub something, I would imagine it would be somewhere centrally located in the city, but this hub is the whole way on the east side. But the GM&O building, I know they're running some of the wave transit out there and some things like that.
That's right. They have a lot of bus transportation that can remain even if you made the train station there. So I think that's a perfectly valid option to look at.
Okay. So, I mean, that or you said even because I do like kind of a pay-as-you-go attitude. In other words, let's not be close-minded to things, but let's not put all our eggs in one basket or platform. And you said it could, by definition, something fairly Spartan could meet the definition that they need for
based on what I've seen on the existing Amtrak lines through Mississippi and also through Alabama. Like I said, it used to run through Atmore and these other small towns where you don't need something the size of New Orleans where it's a major hub.
Right.
It can simply be a stop with restrooms and ticket counter.
So you could put something pretty darn inexpensive up. And then if demand is huge and everybody loves it, then you can build more.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think it's important to view this not within a vacuum, but within a greater plan for downtown Mobile. You know, as we redevelop Water Street, as we redevelop Broad Street, as the airport, if the airport relocates to Brickley Field, this is a large piece of a much bigger puzzle.
Okay, but let's talk demand. And Taxman is texting in, too, and he and I have gone back and forth on this over the years. It's a lot of fun because I ask some of the same questions, although I do come out and publicly say, full disclosure, I think trains are cool. So I do say that out front, but I'm also a guy that tries to look at things, hopefully through a fiscally conservative lens. Is the demand there? And if the demand's not there for this, who holds the bill? In other words, okay, we get this matching money from the feds. Well, we match the money. This thing happens. We start this rail service between New Orleans and Mobile. What if it doesn't work out right?
I think that's a great concern. So Amtrak is federally subsidized. So they are the holders of the purse strings for the Amtrak services. And so before a brick is laid to build a terminal, certainly the right kind of study to show the economic impact would be needed. And there is one study that was published by the University of Southern Mississippi in Hattiesburg that does predict through Louisiana and Mississippi and Alabama that there would be a large economic impact from this, not only from the tourism, the novelty side, which is interesting and important, but not necessarily a reason to bring back a large infrastructure project, but from a business development side. And that's where these can coalesce together.
Business development side. You've gone to this a couple times, Stephen. How does it the train develop business?
The number of companies that do business on the Gulf Coast who either have to rent cars or rent buses or spend a lot of time traveling and losing those work hours is substantial, especially when you look at companies that deal with the port of Alabama and the port of New Orleans.
Right.
And so that's just another mechanism for connectivity where you don't lose those hours. It's cheaper. It's faster to do the business, where you can wake up in Mobile and have one meeting and have another one in New Orleans in the afternoon, and you don't lose that time driving.
Okay, but is that enough? And I don't know these, and I don't ask them for effect, not rhetorically. Is that enough to put enough meat and seats in a rail car to send back to make it worth the while of coming on through and stopping?
When you look at that study from the University of Southern Mississippi, they believe it is.
Okay.
They certainly believe it is. And it was a detailed economic study with projections of ridership and projections of economic impact.
Okay, because economic impact is very important, and it's heady stuff that's out there that is hard for some of us. Ridership is what I think. Salespeople, you know what I'm saying? You could say economic impact. There's some, at least it seems like there's some magic and voodoo how you arrive at those final numbers. But ridership, how many people come on in and sit down and ride that train from point A to point B?
Absolutely. And a lot of that's going to fall on the city of Mobile to promote ridership, to promote the programs, to get people to take the train who maybe wouldn't do it otherwise. And so it's going to take an all hands on deck where if this is really going to work, it's going to have to be a partnership with Brookley Field. It's going to have to be a partnership with the port, downtown Mobile. And so it's definitely feasible and definitely possible, but none of this is going to be possible if we don't get the support from Montgomery that we need. And right now, we're just not seeing it.
There we go. And this is what I was wondering on the GMNO, because we've talked about it in the past, but thank you, Kevin. Said it's not logically feasible. The train used to have a backup into the station to let passengers out, but now it's too far from the main line. So unless, I guess, new tracks. So that was the... But this has to be done and signed by Governor today.
That's correct.
If not, is it gone forever? Is it addressed in the next fiscal year? How does this work?
According to the Southern Rail Commission, it's probably going to come back in the next fiscal cycle of 2019.
Okay.
But certainly this would go away for a year.
Okay. All right. So there you go. That's why you got to pay attention. Also, speaking of paying attention, people want to learn more about your campaign for House District 97. How do they do that?
You can find us on Facebook by looking up Stephen McNair for House 97 or go to votemcnair.com.
All right. Good stuff. Thanks for coming in.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right. We'll do it all again tomorrow for Mobile Morning starting at 6. And Midday Mobile, this show, this very program, will be on the road tomorrow. Not by rail tomorrow, unfortunately, but by tires on the FM Talk 106.5 Mobile Command Unit. So we'll be broadcasting live from Dean McCrary Mazda starting at noon tomorrow. Our friends at Jersey Mike's Subs have hooked us up with great sandwiches, and also we'll have the brand new FM Talk 106.5 Huggers. Just got a new shipment of those. Have those out there tomorrow, plus more goodies. Got some books and stuff I want to hand out, so come on by. See us sometime during your lunch hour. You can slide out somewhere between noon and 2. Dean McCrary Mazda on the East I-65 Service Road. Midday Mobile live from there. All right, Paul Feinbaum Show is next. And reminder, 2 podcast of this show, the morning show, weekend programs, all the great shows we have on in the evenings, all the 38 plus hours of live local content we do every week on this radio station, available through our podcast page. Go to fmtalk1065.com and just do the drop down there for podcast. You can pick your day and you can make your selection right there. Download it or listen to it right there off the website. And speaking of which, too, while you're there, online opinion poll question, which I like, didn't get any chance to hardly talk about today. It's like I was busy with other stuff, but do you support moving Mobile's airport to Brookley? Remember, yesterday we talked about that feasibility study. Right now, 83% of y'all say, yeah, you support it. So let us know what you think. Keep voting. Front page, fmtalk1065.com. All right, y'all have a great one. Feinbaum next. See you in the AM.